And now,
the definition. Definition.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Vladimir Adis, and welcome to a reformatted original episode of Class War Battlefield Podcast. I'm not actually going to do anything particularly special with this episode. I'm just going to give you an introduction. This is actually the re-release of my first episode, Obama and Special Interests. Now, it was fun listening to this again, because I have become so much more, I think, pessimistic since then. This was recorded in September of 2011, and I can definitely say in it I appear to be more of an apologist for Barack Obama, and I definitely am taking to task the progressives in this nation, but I have learned so much in the past year. I have definitely changed my attitude about so many things in the past year. And I've acknowledged more than I wanted to acknowledge on that episode. Now, before I play it, let me give you a little bit of a story about starting this podcast. In 2010... I actually thought about starting a podcast, but truthfully, I was so overwhelmed by the idea. You know, it was, how would I do it? Where would I post it? How would I get people to listen to it? You know, all of that ran through my head. What would I call it? I mean, it was an idea that was great because I know how to talk, but it was so scary because I didn't understand how I could do it. It just was overwhelming to me. Well, a year later, 2011, right before the Occupy movement started, right before it started, I decided one day when I was writing that I should just give it a try and say, what the heck, you know, let me just do it. And the first one actually was very easy. Following it up was very difficult. I was nervous the entire week after I did the first one. And I think back then I was posting on Jumbo Files, which all of those files are now gone because I didn't log into the account for a while, and they just, if you're not active for so long, they just delete everything. So they did. They deleted everything. So that's why I'm posting all of these again. But it was incredibly exhilarating to get the first one out. And I'm still proud of it. I'm very proud of it, actually. And probably if I had more time, I would go back and I would add, you know, clips and stuff to it, but I just don't have the time. I hope you enjoy this. Again, this is the first episode. I'm going to run it from the original beginning. I'm not even going to cut the beginning or anything. I'm just going to run it. And just for some camaraderie, I'm going to run the actual introduction to Class War Battlefield podcast, and then also run the outroduction. So, any of the few people who might be listening who heard the original episode, you know, you're probably first and foremost, if you're listening to this, you're shocked that I'm starting it out like this. But secondly, you're going to be shocked to hear the introduction. So, enjoy, and at the end of a lot of them, for a while, I give the wrong, an old email address. Well, this time, of course, I'll give you the right one. ClassWarBattlefieldPodcast@live.com. Again, ClassWarBattlefieldPodcast@live.com. If you want to be a contributor, I like 5-minute spots, just what's going on around your town, poverty-wise, maybe what's your take on something that's happening. I am not being shy about this. I'm looking for individuals who are conscious, who know how to think outside of the ideology, who know how to reason to a point where you can explain yourself completely. There's a definite need for that. I just don't want people who are shouting to the wind be able to explain yourself in detail and be knowledgeable. All right, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, here's episode one.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. I'm Vyamir Adis. Let's get started. Recently, I've heard many progressives talk about how Obama won't stand up for anything. And while I tend to agree with them, I also would like to remind them that the realities of Washington are often overlooked by the public. Most people do not understand exactly how entrenched the special interests are in Washington. Most people don't actually understand how these special interests work. I used to be one of those people. When I heard the term special interest, I often thought about lobbyists, for they are the most powerful individuals in the government. However, I would submit that that's not true. The most powerful individuals in Washington aren't the lobbyists, and to be honest with you, they're not the financiers. They are, in reality, a group of individuals so secretive that we really don't know about them. The first time that I was turned on to this mysterious cabal was actually, I think it was about a year and a half ago. I got my hands on a copy of The Shock Doctrine, the audiobook version, actually, and I listened to it, and my mouth just dropped open as I listened to this audiobook. This secret history of the United States during the Soviet era, the supposed threat of communism, was used to go into country after country after country and topple democratically elected individuals who wanted nothing more than to break the colonial strangleholds over their people. For years, basically all my life, I had turned away from the negative realities of my country. This shattered that perception.
I was unable to turn away. This really put me face to face with the reality of who my nation was, and the people at the top, and what they really stood for. In this book, Naomi Klein made sure to highlight the fact that the actions that were undertaken to topple these governments wasn't done so to implement democracy. It was done to reverse what we would consider democracy. And actually, having watched closely as the United States entered Iraq in 2003, I scratched my head when reports trickled out that the United States military went into communities that had set up, through their own will, set up new governments. Democratic governments, populist governments, to be honest with you, which one day in the future we'll have to discuss the exact difference between populism and democracy. But the military went in and broke up these governments and decided that they were going to, you know, put into place people who they wanted to deal with. I was shocked about that. But I really didn't make any connection between that's why we actually went into Iraq. And, you know, what subsequently became the economic reality on the ground. You know, fast forward 7-8 months later, I have another audiobook that I had found, and I hadn't really listened to it, but I decided one day at work to listen to this book. It is, I'm not even sure if I'm going to get the title right, but I believe it's called The Secret History of the United States. It's by John Perkins, if my memory serves me correctly, and it's from the guy who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I had never heard of in my entire life. So I'm listening to this book, and again, just almost becoming somewhat emotionally depressed, because hearing this reality stunned me. And what I came away with from listening to that book was, when we talk about special interests out on Main Street, we're thinking lobbyists. But those aren't the special interests that people like Barack Obama really has to deal with. The President of the United States would have to deal with these entrenched cabals. I mean, when you really think about what special interests at the top of our government would look like, it's not lobbyists. Mm-mm. It's the individuals that are involved in the military-industrial complex to the extent that you can't tell where government begins and ends and where the companies that these individuals control began and ends. It often occurs to me that FDR was able to push through some of the things he was able to push through because he understood not only how Washington worked, but he understood where all the bodies were buried for the upper class. Noam Chomsky usually, every now and then when he's talking about the government, he quotes this marvelous line from John Dewey. You know, I think it was back in the 40s when he said it. That government is the shadow big business casts. And as progressives, we fail to realize exactly what kind of business interests are at stake. We are massively intelligent, and we understand that there are entrenched special interests, but we fail to realize how entrenched they are in who they actually are. And when we do realize it, we don't expose it. One of the things that progressives and liberals have not done, and we've not done it very well, is we have not built the institutions to rival I'm struggling for a word for them. You can call them institutions, but I like to call them more maybe benevolent institutions, because they're not necessarily for the public good. They're more like parasites. We have not created the institutions that rival these things. And by not investing our time and our effort into creating these institutions, we are essentially fighting a losing battle right now. And truthfully, as long as we try to reform these institutions instead of taking them on in the market, as it were, I don't know how far we're going to get. The reality is, these individuals have no incentives to change the way that they've been doing business. None. Absolutely none. We could try to appeal to their consciousness, we can try to appeal to their humanity, but newsflash, a lot of these individuals got to where they're at because they show no weakness towards consciousness, and that's, I would imagine that's how they would explain it. They don't let their consciousness get in the way of doing what they have to do. And they don't bow to humanity, because if they bowed to humanity, then they wouldn't do the stuff that they do overseas. We need to realize, like we keep saying to President Obama, or about President Obama, that he needs to realize that the Republicans are just not that into him. We need to realize that these individuals are not interested in being part of the human family as we have defined it. Their idea of free market, supposed capitalism, is they get to control everything, and if we don't like what they do, well, then we can just spend our life in jail. We need to realize that. And unfortunately, I think Obama has realized that the system is not only broken, that it's almost to the point of beyond repair, that the president has no power. Before I end this podcast, I want to say something that I have no doubt that you're going to see as controversial. That I have no doubt that you may think of it as somewhat crazy, but I think it needs to be said. When Obama was elected, he really went into Washington and thought, you know something, we can make a difference. And yeah, he messed up. He surrounded himself with a lot of insiders. And I think he was under the impression that these individuals wanted to do the right thing. And maybe soon after he got in there, you know, the first battle that he had, which was for the stimulus package, he realized that the individuals that he surrounded himself with didn't necessarily want to do the right thing. But he had made his bed. And now, 3 years in, he's let Rom go, finally. You know, he's cleaned house with his economic advisors. And he's finally starting to take some steps that progressives will be happy about. Or, in some cases, would be happy about. But he's still not far enough. And I'm going to tell you why. Because he was never meant. Obama was never meant to be more successful than Clinton. Why? Not because there's some big-ass conspiracy about it, but because Obama came into office after 8 years of just in-your-face, I hate to use this word because I think it's used way too much, but neo-fascism, a new form of fascism, which is so, it is so public, but yet it's so secretive. You know, people don't even realize how much big business controls certain aspects of the corporation and just how much that has sped up in the past decade. So by the time Obama got elected, what could he really do? I mean, one, he actually, in many instances, believes in privatization, so it's not like he's going to reverse that. And two, if he was to start reversing that, the media is to the point where even their liberal commentators, I mean, aside from like Rachel Maddow, and maybe Ed Schultz sometimes. And, you know, I don't count Keith Olbermann anymore because he's over with Current. And Current is just a different animal. And who would have ever thought that Al Gore, who once was thought to be a conservative Democrat, would now be looked upon by the progressives as one of their main heroes and the guy who might be able to save them from the torment of, well, pick any one of your, any number of the conservative Democrats that are out there, but I digress. I don't count Olbermann, any of them, but anyway, the media by itself is, it's 100% behind corporations. I mean, it is a corporate entity, but as it's gotten bigger, it's become more and more entrenched with corporate interests. So, Obama was pretty stuck. And here's where the real controversial part of what I'm saying comes in at. When, years before Barack Obama even thought about running for president, in 2000, when George W. Bush stole the election, when he was handed it, why do you think that happened? Now, Reagan started the privatization notion. Bush 1 continued it. Clinton slowed it down a little bit. He actually cut back on the defense spending. He started, you know, talking about, among other things, curbing our military expenditures. And he really started talking about, particularly at the end of his presidency, he started talking about creating a more civilian-like economy. If Gore came into office, Gore had really transformed himself in the 90s from, again, being considered that conservative Democrat to more of a liberal, and I think he was moving more rapidly into the progressive era. There's definitely a difference between being a liberal and a progressive. We will have to talk about that some other time. And if Gore had became president, I submit to you, one, the financial trouble that we got ourselves into would have been reversed. Wouldn't have happened. I think Clinton set himself up terribly at the end of his presidency, where he rolled back all this regulation. Ready to really stick my neck out there and say that Gore was going to reverse all of that, but I don't know. You know, that's just my feeling. The reason why Bush was given the presidency was to continue what Bush 1 had started, the privatization, to ramp up military spending, because there were many military companies, which Naomi Klein talks about in several of the speeches that she's given about the shock doctrine. There were many companies who are part of the defense industry that were about to go bankrupt. And I submit to you the reason why they were about to go bankrupt was because America under Clinton wasn't so eager to rush into every skirmish that we looked at. Of course, that changed with Bush 1. So you had a lot of corporate interests who really wanted Bush 2, I mean. They really wanted him. So, 8 years of that, I mean, let's be honest, he didn't win the first time. Ohio, there was many problems in Ohio. I'm pretty confident he didn't win the second time, although there's a lot of people who don't believe that. But, whatever. If he did win, he won on the back of 9/11. So, okay. Even though I still don't think he won the second time, but whatever. So by the time when Obama got in, look, everybody and their mama knew that there was no hell in the way that the Republicans were going to win in 2008. It just wasn't going to happen. That is why, basically, John McCain won, you know, the nomination, because there was no hell in the way they were going to pull it off. You would have had, if a Republican won in 2008, you would have had riots the like that you have not seen since the 60s, because people would have known it was flummoxed. I mean, that's one of my things about 2004. You know, people were so pissed off at Bush. How the hell did he win? But he managed to win. Anyway, so when Obama came in, of course, these corporate interests, which were kind of a little bit more lulled, L-U-L-L-E-D, at the end of the Clinton era, had became massively, massively emboldened and empowered to basically get away with whatever the hell they wanted to, both domestically and internationally under Bush 2. What was Obama going to do? I mean, truthfully, what was Obama, with these individuals basically controlling the strings, what was Obama going to do? Not only that, Clinton had effed Obama too, because Clinton had taken the Democratic Party and moved it into the arena of corporate money. So, whereas 25 years ago, the Democratic Party was for working people, was for the impoverished, was for the middle class, and that's where they received most of their donations from, most of their money. most of their power from was these organizations. Clinton had essentially said, where are they going to go? Let's get the corporate money. By the time Obama comes along, he has no recourse but to dip into that trough too. And despite what the media tried to tell us, and they tried, and they had me good with this one. I mean, I took this one hook, line, and sinker. You know, that Obama was receiving so much money from small donors. He was receiving a lot of money from small donors. He was receiving a hell of a lot of money from small donors. But let's not play ourselves. Obama had a lot of corporate sponsors, too. And he was receiving a ton of money from those corporate sponsors. And that's why he has been unable to take some of the more progressive stances that he talked about taking when he was running for office. And truthfully, considering that he's probably going to have to raise $1 billion for this campaign, there's no hell in the way he's going to be progressive during his last 4 years. He can definitely try, but don't think that the Democratic Party is not going to be saying to him, we need these individuals to help us run for 2016, so calm down. This gets me back to what progressives have not done with developing countering institutions. You know, a conservative friend of mine asked me a great question. Why was it that I felt the need to rant on Facebook about all these problems when I could be out there making hundreds of thousands of dollars to be able to change some of these problems? Well, it took me a while to actually come up with the answer. One, he was right. I should have been out there making money. But two, I never saw my aspirations in life to be rich. And I didn't think it was about the money. I thought that it was about making individuals who do have the money, who are born into the money, do the right things. Well, I'm 29 now, and I realized that, you know, that's a great way to view the world, but that's not how the world works. The reality is, progressives have to start building institutions now that's going to counter these individuals. And we're not going to be able to just do it on the media front. We're not going to be able to do it just on the local front. We have to, as Martin Luther King started talking about in his final year of life, we have to radicalize, well, I'll paraphrase what Martin Luther King was talking about. We have to radicalize economic participation. What do I mean by that? We have to think of new solutions to old problems. I'm not going to get into what I'm talking about right now, but you'll definitely hear me talk about this more and more as I become more established with this podcast and as I start doing this more frequently. I want to thank you for joining me today with this podcast. And I really, really look forward to doing this more often. This is my first one, so it's not as organized as I thought it would be, but I hope you enjoyed it. Have a good day. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends?
These governments are killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.
Thank you.